I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few moments, our conversation with author Tom Ricks, who says his book title is now too tame. We'll speak with the author of Fiasco. But first, Congress is racing to finish its summer session, a late-night session last night, and a chance they may work into the weekend. And now President Bush says Congress must stay in session until it approves legislation modernizing the FISA courts, the courts mandated in 1978 to oversee eavesdropping on foreign terror suspects. Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, we understand we're stepping into a sort of a swiftly moving news stream. What's going on now in Congress?
Well, as we are looking at blank screens, actually, neither the House nor the Senate at 12 noon on the last day of the session have announced what the agenda is, which means you are looking at very solid gridlock. In this case, not just among parties, but within them.
Well, first of all, let's back up. Last night, there was a very angry moment that sort of maybe preceded this gridlock. There was a vote to add a provision to the Farm Bill that would have ensured that none of the funding of the bill be used to pay illegal immigrants. Lawmakers in agricultural states want the money. They fear crops won't get picked. Opponents of illegal immigration are against it. They thought they'd won late last night, but then the vote was reannounced. Let's listen.
The chair prematurely called the vote at 2:14.
Well, what happened was the chair said some ballots hadn't been counted yet, paper ballots. The final vote was actually against the provision and therefore allowing the payment. Scale, very testy.
Well, what was striking was that at the time the gavel came down, members in the chamber could look up and see that they had won, that that vote switch had been announced and figured on the board, but the speaker didn't know it, who was handling the gavel at the time. So, but the blow-up, I think, is just an instance of how very bitter feelings have gotten in terms of how the majority is using its power. It reminded many of us of that long vote over the prescription drug bill back
right.
in 2003 that just went on for hours until Republicans got the vote they wanted. Well, Democrats gaveled this one out when the vote was against them, claiming victory. So you can see why anger would be
right.
very high.
Well, the president has now said today he wants a new law on the FISA courts and wiretapping. We read today there have been secret negotiations on this all week. The Bush administration, to remind ourselves, they want to be able to monitor calls and emails routed. Maybe these calls and emails are of originating overseas or of foreign terror suspects. But they may be routed through switches in the U.S.
Exactly.
Bush administration saying when the original law was passed in 1978, this kind of routing didn't exist. So what's the debate there today?
Well, that's just the point. This is an issue that is very difficult for Democrats because it deals with national security. Just a few minutes ago, the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, on the floor said, we must not leave a weakness that we know exists. We will never be able to connect the dots if we can't collect them. And he said the failure to pass this legislation would suggest an indifference on the part of Congress, and the threat is urgent. And that's why I think Republicans are now saying that the only thing that will get through today is likely to be the FISA bill.
Well, but still on the agenda, and I'm sure going to be talking on Monday about, you know, how this week actually ended, but you've been telling us this Congress, you know, elected on a mandate to stop the war, yet the Democrats' attempts at doing that have failed. Still on the agenda, some Republicans apparently joining Democrats to insert an amendment into the defense appropriation bill requiring the president to report to Congress within 60 days on a plan for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. How's that supposed to fare?
Exactly. Well, that was supposed to have come up yesterday, and it didn't, in part because of an intense battle within Democratic ranks over it. You see the left of the Democratic Party feeling that this is a backward step. You know, we have already voted a withdrawal date. Why vote something that just says, let's see your plans? But the other side, some moderate Democrats and even some very strong anti-war Democrats, Neil Abercrombie of Hawaii, spoke to me about it. He's a sponsor, and he said, look, we have to get out, not just have a time certain, but we need to get out in an intelligent way. That requires bipartisanship. We need Republicans to be together with us on this, and this is the only intelligent way to go. There are others who won't let me give their names who say the same thing, that they just feel that the party is getting too focused on elections and forcing Republicans who are vulnerable to vote against the war, when what they really need is something much more bipartisan, and that is what's at issue today.
Gail Shattuck, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, in 2005, when Washington Post senior military correspondent Thomas Ricks was writing Fiasco, his bestseller about the Iraq War, his colleagues warned that the title seemed extreme or maybe premature. Yet by the time the book came out in hardcover last summer, almost no one questioned the title. Now Tom writes in a new postscript that he realizes that when he wrote Fiasco, the low point of the war hadn't even come yet. Fiasco, the American military adventure in Iraq, is now out in paperback. In that new postscript, he also writes Iraq is past fiasco and that Shakespearean tragedies have five acts. In Iraq, we're not even seeing the beginning of Act Four. Tom Ricks joins us from the studios of WRTI in Philadelphia. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
That was very difficult to read. You know, your postscript was really stomach-turning.
Yeah, Iraq is kind of stomach-turning. I have the feeling sometimes that on the one hand, it's everything that's happening seems kind of like it's inevitable. On the other hand, it's all such a slow-motion agony. It's like watching a slow-motion train wreck.
Or as you said, Shakespearean play, fourth act. What do you mean by that? I'm trying to remember what happens in the fourth act and then the fifth of Shakespearean plays.
Well, the fifth act, you remember, is always chaotic and messy. You know, there's dead bodies all over the stage. We're not at that point yet. While there are a lot of dead bodies in Iraq, the thought I had was that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are still alive at this point.
From Hamlet, of course.
Mm-hmm. And that it isn't fully resolved yet. In many ways, we're still in the early days. This is what you might call the Petraeus phase of the war. Act Four, the next act, could well be the regionalization of the war.
Let's pick up on a couple of things that you've said. You write two major changes in 2007, increased troop presence. You write that was a bigger deal. A bigger deal was made about the surge than was warranted. But secondly, replacing General Casey with General David Petraeus, who you just mentioned. He was one of the dissenters, early on. The Bush administration, in appointing him, literally said, okay, we're going to try your way. We've had General Petraeus on the program when he was an outcast. Now, as you said, the Bush administration literally turning the war over to its early detractors. So tell us more about the Petraeus phase.
Well, Petraeus and the people around him have a far better grasp of the requirements of counterinsurgency than their predecessors, especially the early predecessors like General Sanchez. Petraeus had studied this stuff. He wrote a PhD when he was at Princeton on the Vietnam War, came in understanding the theory. And that's why in the postscript to the new edition, I say that it's the troop numbers aren't as important as the way Petraeus is using those troops. He's moved them off the big isolated bases and out into these little combat outposts across Baghdad. And that's really significant. That's what classic counterinsurgency theory says you have to do. And you're right. What's happened here in this phase of the war is the army has essentially said to Petraeus, okay, smart guy, you do it. We'll try it your way because our way didn't work. And the worry here is we didn't start trying that way. We didn't get the strategy right until we were in the fifth year of the war.
You write that his strategy was pretty much telling the troops, don't incur any more enemies than we have. You know, and yet you also write that others in the military are telling you sort of, you know, anonymously, it's too late. And we're hearing, you know, that this timetable for gauging success keeps getting pushed back. It was September, then pushed back to November, pushed back to 2009 in another estimate. And we were just talking about Congress. It seems to make any congressional debate irrelevant if in fact, you know, on the one hand, people are saying it's too late, but it doesn't seem as if there's a goalpost.
Well, it's kind of both things. It's an extremely messy, chaotic, and ambiguous situation. On the one hand, the goalposts do kind of seem to be moving here. We were initially told the surge was beginning in January. Oh, no, they said the surge really didn't begin until June when all the troops were out there. Well, in point of fact, a lot of U.S. troops died over the last 6 months fighting for what we were told was the surge. So it really did begin in January when we started changing the disposition of troops. On the other hand, I think the Bush administration's calculation, and I think it's probably correct, is that Congress, to be Shakespearean about it, will be full of sound and fury but won't do anything about the Iraq war, that ultimately they won't pull the plug on the war. And so what that means is that Bush and General Petraeus essentially have until January 2009 to do as they will in Iraq.
You say it astonishes you that, as you wrote in early 2007, again for this postscript, it appears the two most likely outcomes of what's happening currently are either the country will break up, or Muqtada al-Sadr, the anti-American cleric, the ally of Hezbollah, the backer of a large part of the government, the Shiite leader, will become the country's ruler.
Yeah, right. And it does astonish me that that's an outcome, because both of those are particularly unpalatable. Muqtada al-Sadr is a dedicated enemy of the United States. His organization has fought American troops intensely twice in Iraq in two big rounds of battles. And not only has he survived them, he has stayed in the Iraqi government that we created. And he is probably the single most powerful person in Iraq now. It's an astonishing outcome. On breaking up the country for partition, it struck me. I've been on book tour this week, and a lot of Americans seem to think that's the answer. And one of the points I've been making in speaking is a lot of things in Iraq look like they might be solutions up front, but the more you look at it, the more you turn the rock over, the worse it gets. Partition, dividing the country into three parts, might simply get you three miniature civil wars.
Thomas Ricks, I want to be clear. When you write that you're astonished to find that the two outcomes would be either a splitting up of the country or a Muqtada al-Sadr ruling a united Iraq, do you see any other solution? Do you see any chance for what most Americans and the military or the Bush administration might call success in Iraq?
No, I think the beginning of wisdom, and I think where we should be in the political debate at this point, is there are no good options left in Iraq. The time for that is long past. Where we are now is selecting what is the least bad option. And that's why I think having a sort of tragic sense of this really is important. We have really messed up in this case. I think the Iraq War is going to be of more consequence for this country than the Vietnam War was. We walked away from Vietnam. We will not be able to walk away from Iraq, I think. I think we're going to be enmeshed in one form or another in Iraq and its consequences for many, many years to come, I think for the rest of our adult lives. There are no good possibilities here. We need to figure out how to minimize the damage we've done. If you look at the various options, partition, well, that could easily lead to a variety of civil wars and tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians being slaughtered. Are we willing to stand by and watch that? Another option people talk about is pulling back, letting them have the civil war they seem to want, and containing it. Well, if you liked this part of the war, you're going to love containment. American troops standing by as these people slaughter each other. That's a great recruiting poster for al-Qaeda.
And by the way, former CENTCOM chief Anthony Zinni, who didn't support the decision to go to war in the first place, told you that Congress is drifting towards a policy of containment in Iraq after everything else has failed.
He really thinks that's, and I agree with him, that that's not only where Congress is going, but where we're going as a people without really understanding it. I kind of have the feeling we're imitating Michael Jackson and moonwalking backwards into a policy decision.
Tom Ricks, senior military correspondent for The Washington Post, author of Fiasco, now out in paperback. We'll have much more with Tom after a quick break. Also, this reminder later in the show, the aftermath of that bridge collapse, questions about how much the Minnesota Department of Transportation knew about the vulnerabilities of the I-35 bridge. Back in a moment, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here Now, and we're back with more from Tom Ricks, senior military correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Adventure in Iraq, now out in paperback with a new postscript, in which Tom says the war has only deteriorated in the year since he published the book. Tom, you were just saying that there are, in your opinion, no good options left in Iraq. If it's so inevitable, then why not leave now and at least save American troops?
It's a moral position to argue, and I've heard a small number of military officers in Iraq make the argument along those lines, which is, look, a big bloody civil war is inevitable here. So all we're doing is delaying the inevitable. So we should redeploy, fall back, and let it happen. The problem with that, as one UN official said to me, is that he considered it a war crime. He said, you people created this mess. You occupied this country. You have obligations under international law as an occupier not to allow that to happen.
And yet you quote a military person who told McClatchy Papers that within a day of the U.S. pulling out, Shiite leaders will have killed every Sunni leader in the country.
Yeah, and there are indications that at least some Shiite factional leaders they would welcome that opportunity. There's a phrase I've heard used in scientific theory called a wicked problem. And a wicked problem is one for which there not only is no obvious solution, but that every possible solution you introduce to it makes the problem worse. And I think that we have to think of Iraq as a wicked problem.
Things keep floating up as I speak to you. Maybe a Nelson Mandela will surface. Maybe, you know, could it be like Northern Ireland? We just saw the British troops pull out without a whisper from anyone after 38 years. I mean, do you see a scenario where, you know, possibly 38 years down the road, you know, with an occupation might that last that long, but have, you know, at least a good outcome?
I think it's possible the occupation could last a decade or two. When I was writing Fiasco, I would look out the window at these little kids every day who would walk from the elementary school near my house up to a daycare center at 3 o'clock, and I would think that one of those kids is going to fight and die in Iraq. Not a happy thought, but in some ways an optimistic one, because it means we wouldn't have been ejected from Iraq by a new anti-American leader. I don't see a Mandela-like figure emerging in Iraq. There's been no indication of someone who transcends sectarian differences. My nightmare scenario, though, does kind of track that thought, which is if we screw this up long and bad enough, you could see a new leader emerge in Iraq who united Iraq under the banner of anti-Americanism. And he takes all that money he gets from the oil when he finally starts pumping it, billions of dollars, and he buys himself nuclear weapons. And he threatens Tel Aviv, New York, and Washington.
Well,
you can see why John Stewart called me Little Miss Sunshine.
I have to say, you've brought tears to eyes with, you know, with this, you know, despair that you outline. But you do say you see a sliver of hope in what's happened. You say this at the end of your postscript. What is that?
The sliver of hope I see, and it is just a sliver, is that I do think we are kind of coming out of that 9/11 panic in which we made a series of bad decisions as a government and as a nation, as a people. And I think we're coming back into equilibrium more. And as part of that, the U.S. Congress has stopped hiding in the basement. And that's not a partisan crack. It's the Democrats and Republicans both basically abdicated the role of Congress after 9/11, ceased to be a co-equal branch of government, provided no oversight. One reason I wrote Fiasco is I had a bunch of questions about the war. How did this happen? Why did this happen? Why is the war being conducted in such a way? Even basic questions. How much does this war cost a week? There were no answers there 4 years into the war before Congress actually started asking some questions. That said, I don't think this Congress is going to do to get us out of Iraq, nor do I think the next president, which is probably going to be a Democrat, it looks like. I don't think the next president is going to get us out of Iraq anytime soon. I would not be surprised if the end of the next president's first term or even second term, we still had troops on the ground in Iraq.
Tom Ricks, what are Americans supposed to do about this? If, in fact, you've been right in the past and if you are right about the future, what are we supposed to do?
Pay attention. And I think they should also talk to their members of Congress. I find that Americans don't think they can have any influence on this war, partly because of what's happened in Congress this year. I don't think that's true. They may not get what they want, but I think they need to make it clear to the U.S. government, whatever they believe, that they believe those things and that they want the Congress to think about this, talk about this.
We spoke with someone that you've spoken to. In fact, you highly regard Major Dan Morgan. He was just on the program talking about how the U.S. should learn from the Soviets' mistakes when the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan. He said things like the U.S. should try to get Iran to stop supporting the insurgents, that the U.S. should not make the war in Iraq and withdrawal a public issue, should not make it a political issue. And to me, you know, all of those things seem impossible. We're in an election year. Of course, this is going to be heavily debated. It seems as if, you know, the U.S. might be marching lockstep down the same path the Soviet Union took. Your thought?
Well, a couple. First, we're living with the consequences of bad decisions. And so the sense of lockstep comes from, you know, the ball is just rolling down the hill and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. Dan Morgan is a very bright guy. In many ways, he reminds me of the best and brightest of in American troops. These guys who just go out and do their absolute best and bust their hearts.
But I want to say that because you point out that these are the, you know, what's happened, especially under David Petraeus, the best of the military are now there in Iraq trying to figure this out.
They are, but at the same time, it reminds me of the line by the poet William Butler Yeats, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I do find officers in Iraq who have lost their hope. One officer told me she was going to quit the military next year because she no longer trusts her government, and she is one of the best. While back here on Fox News, I see the worst full of passionate intensity and no understanding of the war.
Thomas Ricks, senior military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of Fiasco, which is now out in paperback with the new postscript we've been talking about. Tom Ricks, it's not a pleasure talking to you, but we really do appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, when we come back, what was it like to ride a bridge as it goes down here and now? I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Authorities in Minneapolis say 8 people remain missing rather than the 30 that had been feared lost after the collapse of the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis. 5 have been confirmed dead. Nearly 80 are injured. Suzanne Blundell is one of those recovering. She has a back injury and also one of those who plummeted through the air Wednesday night. She was in her car on the bridge and fell, landing on another segment of slab that had already hit the water. We reached her at the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview.
The cement that my car was on just went straight down to the water. They said it was about like a 65-foot drop or so.
Wow. What did that drop feel like?
Oh, it was horrible because, you know, the road started, first the highway started to shake, and then it almost started to, like, wave back and forth, and then there was a huge, like, buckle in the road, and then it just did, like, 3 big drops, and that's when we hit the water.
You are, I'm sure, feeling very lucky, although in the hospital recovering.
Yeah.
But were you aware of people who were not so lucky around you?
When we did get out of my car, we could hear people screaming, like, in the water, because the water was, like, it was, like, 5 feet next to us, so we could hear people screaming from there, because there was part of the, you know, bridge that was still over them where they were stuck in their cars, and it was just horrible. I did see 2 of them climb out of the water, and but I didn't see anybody, like, physically just, like, go down, you know. Mm. I know that did happen.
Well, Suzanne, we really wish you well, and the doctor said you're going to have a speedy recovery?
Yeah, they said that it's just going to be pain for a couple of weeks, just soreness from the impact. And then after that, I should be okay.
Can you compare that 60-foot fall to anything? I mean, is it like a roller coaster? Have you had?
Oh, God, no. There's nothing I can compare it to. I couldn't even explain it. Mm. It's just the highway just started collapsing, and we just went down, and nothing compares to the feeling that felt like.
Well, we wish you well, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Suzanne Blundell of Minnesota, who, again, survived, obviously, the collapse of the bridge, joining us now. And again, news from the newsroom of WCCO, CBS News Radio in Minneapolis, Jack Rice. Jack, I just want to ask you, given what Suzanne was saying, you know, seeing these people stuck under the slabs of cement, we're hearing today that authorities have scaled down the number of people missing. They say they're looking for 8, and yet we've been hearing reported that 50 cars are submerged. So does that mean that many more people did get out?
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it? We've heard so much bad news hour after hour after hour that when they've been able to lower this number to 8, at least that's some good news. Now, nobody is saying necessarily that it's only going to be 8. There may be others that we're just not aware of at this point. But at least at this point, we're pretty shocked that these numbers are as low as they are.
And how are authorities saying they're going to go about this recovery effort? This is, you know, in plain view of the entire city, this river. They're going to have to lift that slab. Who knows? I mean, are they going to tent it? How are they saying they're going to do this?
I don't see that they could possibly tent something like this. I was down at the Mississippi just this morning dealing with this, and I've been covering this almost every hour since it hit. And realistically, now it dropped at 6:05 p.m. on Wednesday night. Since that time, we have seen a lot. And since that time, it's made it very, very difficult. As a result, I think what's probably going to happen here is we're going to at least watch what happens, but we don't know necessarily what's going to happen. I think there's not much that they can do. Here's the difficulty. The difficulty is it has very, very strong currents. In addition to that, there's very, very little visibility. I've had a chance to talk with some of the divers involved, and down deep, you might have 12 to 15 inches of visibility here. To make matters worse, because the currents are so strong, a lot of this debris is starting to shift, including some of the cars, including the rebar, including the concrete. So what we've seen from the divers is they've decided that rather than going downriver, they're going upriver to try to avoid having something shift on top of them. The Army Corps of Engineers has tried to do a little bit more. They've gone to the locks, which are also upriver, lowered the level of the water by about a foot to a foot and a half, maybe 2 feet, and hopefully that will make a difference. But at this point, they have not been able to take any of those bodies out of the river itself. This last one that went from 4 to 5, that was taken from the rubble outside of the water.
Well, as we reported extensively yesterday, the bridge has been designated structurally deficient as early as 1990. And now we're hearing today in the Star Tribune, and this seems to be the news of the day, that there was fierce debate in the State Department of Transportation last winter about this bridge, whether or not to bolt steel plates to the bridge's supports to prevent this fatigued metal from cracking, or simply continue to inspect it. What's been the fallout from this?
I think there is fallout here, but I think what's happening is people are hesitant to go too aggressively at this one. There are still the dead that are in the river, and people all know that. But I do think that almost immediately, everybody had the same question on their lips. They kept asking, how did this happen? Why did this take place? And people are looking around, trying to understand this concept of structural deficiency. If there are 141,000 people every single day that cross this bridge, it's one of the most popular, most used bridges in the Twin Cities of about 2.5 million people. Why is it that this was allowed to go on the way that it was?
Well, and we should say the state was given these two alternatives by the engineers who had done a study about the cracks, and they chose the second alternative that was given, which was the inspection route, and they began that examination last May. So, they were given those two choices by those who had done the study.
You're right. Actually, what they determined on this one, too, and this seems to be the logic behind it, is that if they had bolted these steel plates in place, they would have had to drill so many additional holes for the bolts that it may have also weakened the bridge. So it was sort of the lesser of two evils, if you will. Mm-hmm. But, of course, now in hindsight, everybody's wondering whether or not that was the decision to make.
Well, Jack, we just got a couple minutes. I want to ask you, so an 8-lane bridge has been knocked out, a central artery in the state and the city. The river's been knocked out. The train, which the bridge fell on, has been knocked out. And we understand it's going to take years to rebuild the infrastructure. So what's happening, as far as shipping, business, all commutes, all of those questions?
I had a long conversation with both U.S. senators yesterday, Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat, and Norm Coleman, a Republican, about this very topic. The president is going to be out here tomorrow. They have already allocated $5 million to try to deal with that in the short term. But again, both of the senators have gone back to Washington looking for in excess of $100 million more. Realistically, this is going to have a massive impact, not just upon the commuters here, but also upon the shipping, as you've described. And also, this roadway is significant for truckers because a lot of what comes into the cities happens to come through this roadway. And so now they're going to have to figure some alternative route. It's going to be very complicated, very costly, and is going to have a massive impact upon the upper Midwest.
And real quick, we know that there's a bridge that runs parallel. Is that going to now be made, into the, or is that, was that bridge also structurally deficient? Is that going to be shut down?
No, the one that's running parallel to it. At this point, nobody has an answer for that. They're using that bridge to help stage for the recovery effort itself. But it has been shut down. The only difference is that the bridge that collapsed was called a deck steel truss bridge. That's different than that second bridge. Ah. It's a slightly different design.
But so, as you say, that second bridge also shut down for staging. So just a terrible mess there. Jack Rice, reporter for WCCO, CBS News Radio in Minneapolis. We greatly appreciate it, Jack. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay. We're going to take a switch gears a little before we go today. Don't forget new music from Prince. You're listening to Here and Now. And now, some time to catch up with your thoughts. Last week, guest host David Boeri spoke with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg about the increased use of the word homeland to describe the U.S. For example, the recent National Intelligence Estimate used the word 11 times in a two-page summary report, and Homeland Security Advisor Frances Townsend also used the word in a Fox television interview. That conversation prompted Margaret Baker of Portland, Oregon, to write, "I hate the term homeland. It smacks of Nazi propaganda and is typical of this administration's attempts to coerce mindless, uncritical patriotism and undermine democracy." Well, David also told you about Oscar the Cat, who has an uncanny knack of predicting when the residents of a Providence, Rhode Island nursing home are about to die. This brought back memories for listener Sarah Smith of Somerville, Massachusetts. She writes, "My mother stayed in our home while she was dying of cancer. We had two cats, and neither of them were likely to cuddle up with anyone at night. But one night, I woke up with one, Mortiana, curled up next to me. I remember when my dad came in the next day to tell me Mom had passed during the night. I said I was glad Mortiana had stayed with me, and I've always thought she must have known what was going to happen, and that's why she came in. You back up my theory." Well, thank you, Sarah. I can also attest that my cat Phil, years ago, ran into my room and literally pointed upstairs where there was a burglar. Cats have it going on. On a recent show, reporter Meghna Chakrabarty profiled Janet Martin, the Massachusetts woman who's launched a crusade against plastic grocery bags. Many, many of you wrote applauding Janet's efforts. David Roth of Orleans, Massachusetts, sent his 1991 song.
I do not need a bag, I do not need a bag to take a brand new bag. Each time a shop's a drag. Thank you kindly, but I do not need a bag.
Okay, your responses in music are also welcome. Couple of baseball notes now. Recently, David Boeri spoke with former New York Times sports columnist Robert Lipsyte. Robert wrote in a blog that the game of baseball would be improved if the out-of-the-park home run were banned, and he and David talked about the excitement that can be found in a good hit-and-run play. Well, that provoked Lois Berkowitz of Oro Valley, Arizona, to write, "Just as everyone has a favorite ice cream flavor, every baseball fan has a favorite individual game. Sometimes the home run provides the drama. Sometimes it's a great hit-and-run play. Banning home runs makes as much sense as standardizing all ballparks. The more ways to score runs, the better. Baseball ain't broke. Don't fix it." And Ben Horner of Bow, New Hampshire, wrote to point out an omission in our conversation with Bill Littlefield about Baltimore Oriole Cal Ripken Jr. entering the Hall of Fame last weekend. Ben writes, "There's another guy going in the hall with Ripken. He's got 8 National League batting titles, 5 gold gloves, 3,000 hits, and was a great ambassador to the game." You're right, Ben. So here's a tip of the cap to San Diego Padre great Tony Gwynn, who also, by the way, ended his career with a lifetime .338 batting average. And finally, Mitch Fink from Boise, Idaho, wrote after yesterday's interview with Linda Ronstadt saying, "Don't tease me. Can't we hear more of Linda's version of the Jimmy Webb song, 'The Moon is a Harsh Mistress'?" Well, yes, we can, shall we? As always, we'd love to hear from you. Our address is letters@here-now.org or give us a call, 617-358-0397. We'll leave you with Linda and come back in 1 minute with the music of Prince. After the break, Here and Now.
I fell down on my face. Yes, I did.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Prince seems to get it. As an artist, he's weathered the mercurial world of pop, several name changes, and a bitter contract dispute over a span of 30 years. He's known for his swings, from James Brown-styled funk to grinding rock riffs. His eccentric and reclusive lifestyle. But now, Prince is everywhere. He made a showing on American Idol last year, rocked the house at this year's Super Bowl, and his new CD, Planet Earth, debuted high in the top 10 in the U.S. this week.
Come with me.
Prince made headlines for giving copies of Planet Earth away for free in every paper in a July edition of The Mail in Britain. And for the first time, he's allowed his music to be used in a commercial. Pop culture correspondent Renee Graham, who's actually interviewed the elusive Prince for an hour and a half, Renee?
Yes, I have.
Well, a longtime fan, and she joins us to talk about the evolution. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
What was that like, by the way, sitting in the room with him?
He smelled better than any human being I've ever been in the presence of. He is just this adorable, delicious little man, and he could not have been more charming.
Well, there you go. We'll talk more about what his, you know, reputation at times has been, given that. But why is he suddenly everywhere?
He's got music he wants people to hear, and that's what he's always been about. He's doing things people would have thought Prince would never have done, playing on something like American Idol, appearing in the Super Bowl halftime show. He wants people to know he's still out there, and I think he's really concerned about the way the music industry has shifted to people who are about more style than substance. He wants, as he always says, you know, real music by real musicians, and I think he takes every opportunity he can get to show that.
Well, let's listen to one, that jaw-dropping performance at the Super Bowl.
Purple rain, that's all right. Come on, y'all. Purple rain, oh yes. Don't it feel good? Only wanna see you, can I play this guitar?
It's a Super Bowl MVP.
That's right. Well, so that's the populist side. Then there's the exclusive side. Tell us more about that.
He's been doing lots of these little shows. Last year and into this year, he had this engagement at a club in Vegas. He took the club over, renamed it 3121, which was the name of his 2006 album. And he's playing shows, $125 a ticket, but he played for hours and hours in a club setting. You don't really usually see Prince in a club setting. And then this year, he's been playing at the Roosevelt Hotel in Hollywood at a cost of $31.21 per couple. But again, playing on and on, playing into the wee hours of the morning. And again, it's only been playing, he's been playing for about 100 people or so at a time.
Well, and let's just to underscore that, when you say $31.21 per couple, that's $3,121 per couple.
And every review I've read has said it's worth every single dime.
Isn't that
and
something?
Then more recently, he's played a show in the Hamptons, $3,000 a ticket.
Yeah.
So, you know, not for those shows aren't for everyone. Not everyone's got that kind of money unless you don't want to pay your mortgage. But for those who can afford, it's been a really good time.
Well, and again, to offset it, he keeps doing these populist things like giving away copies of Planet Earth. He made a deal with The Mail, the newspaper in Britain, and readers got a free copy.
You can't get much more populist than free CDs in your Sunday newspaper. It's just the new album that's out now, Planet Earth. And, you know, it's not something that I think his record company was necessarily happy about. But it's, for him, it's always been about the distribution of his music, getting his music out there in the most effective way possible.
Let's hear a little of the new track, which I wish had been in my paper when I opened it. This is from Planet Earth. And this is guitar. It was used in a Verizon commercial.
Get dirty at the club, yeah. Usually round your waist like a chain, but then I got the call, so I jumped in my car. I love you, baby, but not like I love my guitar.
Renee, I don't know, when I hear the Beatles or another group, their music being used in a commercial, you sometimes think, are they, you know, is this selling out? Where do you weigh in on that?
you know, I'm sort of over that now. It doesn't really bother me anymore. I think, especially for someone like Prince, he's 49 years old now. He's not going to get the radio airplay he once had. He's not going to be in MTV's rotation when MTV actually bothers to play videos anymore. He has to get his music out there any way he sees fit, and putting it in a commercial, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Lots of younger artists are doing it. Mm-hmm. So, and U2 has done it. John Mellencamp has done it. There's no reason why Prince shouldn't do the same.
So, especially, as you said, since radio play is so terrible. Well, so what do you think of the new CD, Planet Earth?
I think the CD is good. You know, is it great Prince? Does it match up to Dirty Mind or 1999 or Sign of the Times? No. But then again, I'm not sure it really has to. It's a solid album. It's much more rock than funk. And he does some very interesting things. And what's been interesting is to watch this evolution. You know, he's not doing the same music he did 10 years ago or the same music he did 30 years ago. You know, he still has his certain obsessions, you know, women, sexuality, but it's portrayed in a much different way. He's a Jehovah's Witness now, so he really doesn't do the more salacious tracks he once did. But his concerns are still the same, you know. But it's a good album. It's a very good album.
Well, you know, I just want to touch on that because you mentioned some of those perceptions of Prince as sort of a misogynist, supporting women like Sheila E., but only if they were half naked. You know, what is your sense of him?
I never really saw him as misogynist. I mean, I think there were songs that people first certainly found disturbing. A song called Lady Cab Driver from his 1999 album comes to mind. But one of the things that's always been interesting about Prince is that duality between sin and salvation, between hedonism and heaven. And lots of artists have had this, from Little Richard to Marvin Gaye, but with Prince it really played out in his music, where at one moment he would have something that was a gospel song, it was almost a prayer to heaven, and the other one would be songs with titles we can't say on the radio.
Let's listen to another cut. This is the one you want to see.
I know you're in a hurry, baby, so let me make this fast.
Next, or is that the excitement?
This is my dream year for Prince. 2008, I think, will be a huge year. You think he's everywhere now, just wait till next year. Because 2008 is not only the 30th anniversary of his debut album, For You, which came out when he was 19 years old in 1978, but it's also his 50th birthday. And I don't think there's any way he's going to let that year go by quietly.
All right.
I'm hoping for a huge tour, 30th anniversary tour.
And, of course, now that you and Prince are like this,
you
have
no idea how close we are.
Here now is pop culture correspondent Renee Graham. For more on Prince, go to the website here-now.org. Renee, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston and of Chris Cuff, Uber intern. He writes, he reports, he soothes guests with his lovely Scottish lilt, and he bakes shortbread. Chris leaves today. We'll miss him, and we wish him well. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend. Please join us again here and now.
Would you let me take care of you? Do all the things that only a best friend can. Best friends can.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.